Case number 13-5270, NACS, formerly known as National Association of Convenience Stores et al., versus Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System, appellant. Ms. Wheatley for the appellant, Mr. Waxman for the amici curiae, and Mr. Coffin for the appellees.
May it please the Court, I'm Catherine Wheatley for the Federal Reserve Board. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. We're talking here this morning.
Wait, can you wait 1 minute?
I'm sorry?
There's still people running around.
Yeah, hold on just a second. Thank you.
Right. Okay, David, you're okay.
Okay, go ahead. Thank you.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Thank you, Your Honor. This case involves the straightforward issue of whether the board's rules regarding network exclusivity and routing and the fees allowable for interchange are unequivocally foreclosed by Section 920 of the Electronic Fund Transfer Act, and if not, whether the board's policy decisions reflect a permissible interpretation of the statute. Let me first talk about network exclusivity and routing. Debit cards currently operate over two main authentication methods, the signature in which you sign the slip or PIN, which is based on the ATM infrastructure. Signature is based on credit card infrastructure. Because of their historical roots, it's easier for cards to be enabled with different PIN networks, but
no,
not...
We've read the briefs.
Thank you.
We understand how these networks work. On which you folks, we don't have that much time. So
before our rule was effective, the networks had exclusivity clauses in their agreements that prevented merchants or issuers from having multiple options available on their cards in some cases. To put an end to those exclusivity arrangements, Section 920B1A requires the board to issue regulations providing that an issuer or payment card network cannot, by contract, requirement, condition, penalty, or otherwise, restrict the number of payment card networks on which a transaction may be processed to less than two unaffiliated networks. The board's regulation does exactly that. In fact, it does it in the very words of the statute.
What about the district court's argument that this is supposed to focus on ensuring two unaffiliated networks for each transaction? That's
Your Honor,
what the district court found. Why don't you focus on that?
Sure.
Because we understand how this all works.
Thank you.
And then I want you to get quickly to the exchange fee.
Okay.
Okay.
The language of the statute does not require two unaffiliated networks for every transaction. It's focusing on affirmative restrictions imposed by the issuer or the payment card network. It's the language, as I just said, is we have to have regulations providing that the issuer or network shall not restrict. Now, what the merchants say is that the important word is transaction in that paragraph, in that section, but the important word really is restrict. It's looking at the restrictions imposed by networks and issuers on the number of networks available for a transaction. The networks and issuers are not the ones that restrict the number. Now that there's a minimum of two networks available on every card, the networks and issuers are not the ones who are restricting the number of networks available to fewer than two. So in our view, the district court just misread the statutory provision, which is aimed at restrictions by issuers and merchants.
Why don't you go on to the exchange fee, and maybe you could start with explaining the fixed cost issue for us and how fixed costs can be incremental costs.
So
would you start there?
Yeah. I certainly can, and I would like to put aside for the moment whether they can be incremental costs, because the main point on the fee provision is that we are not limited in the statute to incremental costs, and I think that this is again the misunderstanding or the misreading of the district court. The board's instruction from Congress is to establish a standard that where the fees will be reasonable and proportional to the cost incurred by the issuer with respect to the transaction. So That's the main goal here, reasonable and proportional to the cost. Congress then provided some additional instruction to us about things to think about, but did not say, as the merchants would have you believe, that those are the only things that the board can take into consideration. We have to consider.
You're just saying little one and little two do not equal 100% of
all
possibilities.
That's right. Between must and may not, there's a big empty space, and that's may, and that's what the board looked at to see what costs are.
So then let me refine my question a little bit. How can fixed costs be related to a specific transaction?
So what the board looked at was and considered was costs that had to be incurred in order for an electronic debit transaction to occur. And so for example, if you have a server over which these transactions are implemented, if you don't have the server, you don't have the transaction. So that is going to be a cost that it's a cost incurred by the issuer with respect to the transaction.
I was surprised that the board didn't define incremental costs, which at least would normally be thought to encompass long-run incremental costs.
Well, I think,
that was a move I was surprised the board didn't make, which wouldn't even involve addressing the comma issue.
Well, exactly. One of the difficulties with a word like incremental is that it's very difficult. There is not a standard definition of it.
And long-run incremental costs is clearly a subset of incremental costs.
That is one way to think about it. There were people who provided comments who were thinking, as I think in some ways the merchants are thinking, each individual transaction, the incremental cost of that one transaction is what Congress had in mind. What we determined was we didn't actually have to enter that thicket and define incremental costs, because what we did was we looked at all of the costs that are incurred other than the ones that we're prohibited from looking at under Romat II.
So you're saying it has to be fixed with respect to authorization, clearance, and settlement?
No, it does not have to. So I would say no, we are not saying that it has to be fixed with respect to authorization, clearance, and settlement. What we're saying is that unless it is prohibited by Romanet II, other costs incurred by an issuer which are not specific to a particular electronic debit transaction, unless it's prohibited by that, we can consider it. There are costs that we must consider, and those are the ones that are incremental costs.
Well, do you consider the transaction monitoring, network fees, do you consider them to be fixed?
Network fees, no, network fees are not fixed.
Just trying to understand what your answer was to my question with respect to fixed only with respect to authorization, clearance, and settlement. What are the fixed costs you're talking about?
The types of fixed costs we're talking about, labor costs, we're talking about the costs of computer system, software and hardware. Those are the types of fixed costs that we included in the standard.
And they're not within the compass of authorization, clearance, settlement?
You're right. Those are within authorization, clearance, and settlement costs. I was just making the point that we are not required under the statute.
I understand that argument. I just am trying to understand your answer to my question on what kind of fixed costs are we talking about. You don't mean to suggest all fixed costs are includable. That's not what your argument
Correct.
Has been. So what I thought it was mostly about fixed costs related to authorization, clearance, and settlement.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Let me ask you about your definition of this phrase.
I
want to ask you about your definition of this, the way the board interprets, specific to a particular transaction. As you just said, the board interprets that as necessary, right? All costs necessary to complete a transaction, right?
Yes.
Okay. So when you get to transaction monitoring, though, a different category, the board has a different definition of the same phrase specific to a particular transaction. It says it means only per transaction costs, not system-wide costs.
Transaction monitoring.
Yeah. So how can, the same phrase mean one thing for fixed costs and another thing for monitoring costs?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I don't think that we changed our
Well, tell me. That's the question?
Right. I don't think
that... What am I misreading here?
What we're saying about transaction monitoring costs is that they are in fact, part of the authorization process. Transaction monitoring is... there are a lot of parts of authorization that involve checking to make sure that the...
So those are ACS costs? Is that the point?
Yes, those are part of ACS costs.
Is there a way that the issuers can distinguish between fraud prevention and other aspects of transaction monitoring?
As I understand it, transaction monitoring is a part of the authorization process that cannot be divided up into part that's for fraud and part that's not for fraud.
The reason I raise the question is that there is an explicit provision on fraud prevention.
That's right.
Which is subject to the procedures being compliant with rules, and the argument is made that including them in this category rather than in the fraud prevention bucket enables the issuers to avoid that constraint.
Right, and what we would say is that what we've done in the fraud, the separate fraud adjustment, is to limit that only to programmatic activities that are intended to reduce fraud, not in a particular transaction, not at the transaction level, but in over the entire program.
What would be an example of something that falls in the latter category?
In the
specific transaction category.
So in the specific transaction category, yeah. That is, among other things, that would be the fraud monitoring. I mean, I'm sorry, the transaction monitoring that we included within the interchange fee standard.
So what would be included in A5? There
may be
employee training and things?
Right. Compliance programs and perhaps public announcements and outreach.
But as Judge Williams says, A5 requires that those costs be subject to certain standards set by the board. Right?
And yes.
Why wouldn't that be true also of monitoring activities for specific transactions? Like, for example, I assume you're talking about those computer algorithms that spot unusual purchases, right?
Right.
Why wouldn't that also have to be subject to the board standards under A5?
Well, A5 doesn't speak about the A5 does not direct us to limit to include everything that could possibly relate to fraud. In fact, as I mentioned, there's many parts
of it doesn't say that. I agree with that.
And therefore, because transaction monitoring also fits within A4. And actually, A3, the reasonable and proportional to the cost incurred by the issuer, because it can be covered in that section, the board chose to put it there carefully, keeping those same costs out of the separate
I agree, but there must be – I agree with you about that. That is, that A5 doesn't require all fraud monitoring to be there. But since it does have to be subject to guidelines or regulations set by the board, I guess I would have thought that the costs that don't have to be included there don't have to be subject to those standards, and there should be some substantive difference between them.
Well, certainly the board could have put these transaction monitoring costs into the fraud adjustment, the separate fraud adjustment. But in our view, they were not required. The board was not required to do that.
All the costs in A2 and A3, and none under A5.
No, because there are costs that are not related to authorization, clearance, and settlement that relate to fraud prevention, such as public service announcements, such as these other things that we've been talking about that are broader programmatic.
Doesn't it seem a little odd to you that Congress would have wanted the public service announcements to only be done pursuant to regulations approved by the board, but everything else doesn't need to comply with fraud prevention regulations? That doesn't make sense to me.
The line that the board drew was between the costs that related to authorizing the transaction itself, which we saw as being encompassed within A3, and other costs relating to fraud prevention that are covered in A5. And so we drew the line there.
You just stated the conclusion. I still don't know.
And so why Congress would have done that?
I don't understand the principle that guides where that line is, other than one's under A3 and one's under A5. And I haven't heard that yet.
Your Honor, I can't get inside the mind of Congress, but
I was trying to get inside the mind of the board.
So the mind of
Congress
the board
is hopeless, but the board that's who we're trying to review here.
The way we read the statute was to enable us to put in the interchange transaction fee all of the costs that are related to that are incurred by the issuer with respect to the transaction, and because that includes this transaction monitoring element, we included that. I know that that's not answering your question about why Congress would have made that choice.
No, I wasn't asking a question about Congress. I promise. I was asking the question about why the board distinguished between these two different categories. And speaking of that, let me take you back to fixed costs for a minute. Let's assume you're right, that there are fixed costs related to specific transactions that can be included. Can you help me understand, and this is another line-drawing question, how the board distinguished between those it included and those that it didn't? I'll give you an example.
Let me just give you an example.
It allows them to include computer services and internet connection fees, for example, but not production of the cards themselves.
Well, one of the things that Congress directed us to look at was the comparison to check, which clears at par. And the provision of the card is a good example of the way in which the board did that. Uh-huh. When in the check transaction world, banks are not reimbursed for producing the checks. Consumers pay for it, but the banks are not reimbursed through the clearance system. And so for that reason, we determined that the card itself, the price of the card, creating the card, was not one that we were going to include.
That's interesting. Let me try another one on you. It includes, that's a good point, but it includes, the board included fixed fees charged by third parties, right, who process these transactions, but it excluded corporate overhead, which could easily be disaggregated.
The way the board saw this was that overhead was something that was not sufficiently at the level of, say, executive compensation, was not incurred by the issuer with respect to transactions. That those overhead costs would exist anyway, and for that reason, they were excluded from the fee standard.
I just have just one more question. Suppose we thought that some of these specific items, like fixed costs or transaction monitoring, either shouldn't be included or that there wasn't sufficient explanation for it. Should we vacate the rule or?
The issue of vacating the rule was hotly discussed at the district court level, and that's right. And the district court determined that it was going to keep the rule in place while the board worked on a revision. And I would think that would be the appropriate thing to do here as well. The industry and all of the players in the debit card world are relying on this rule to limit the fees, and certainly Congress wants the fees limited from where they had been before, which was double at least what the 21 cents fee that we've imposed here.
Okay.
So we would certainly say that at most the
okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. With the Court's permission, I'll reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Let me go first to some of the questions, Judge Tatel, that you were asking with respect to interchange fees. The district court found that the language of Section 920 is so clear that under Chevron Step 1, it is impossible to read the language of Section 920 to include the four categories of costs that are actually challenged in this litigation. That is incorrect. Section 920 contains, in addition to all the rulemaking requirements, contains one mandate that governs primary conduct, not what the board shall do. And it's included in A2, and it's repeated in A3, and it mandates that interchange fees, quote, shall be reasonable and proportional to the cost incurred by the issuer with respect to the transaction. There is no way that that language can be read to exclude the four costs that are at issue in this case. Indeed, we think our position is that there is no way that that language can be read to exclude any of those costs, and for that matter, some other costs that the board didn't include.
Well, they do have to be related to specific transactions, don't they?
Excuse me?
The costs have to be related to a specific transaction.
The question is,
do these four categories fit that standard?
Exactly right. We think that they do, and I mean, I'll just tick through them.
Go ahead.
Okay, the network charges, that is the amount that the issuer has to pay the network in order to engage in the process of authorization, clearing, and settlement, are clearly particular to a specific transaction. They are charged on the basis of that transaction.
And what about fixed?
Excuse me?
What about fixed?
Okay, so fixed, yeah. The statute doesn't talk about fixed costs.
No.
It talks about costs. And what the board did in its regulation was to say, we are going to include what they called transactions processing costs. That is, those costs, whether they are, quote, average fixed or average variable, that are, in fact, specific to particular transactions and that are necessarily incurred in the course of effecting a transaction.
Uh-huh.
Now, I was certainly going to make the Telric point that Judge Williams has already made, but the board properly understood, and we think that all of these costs are incremental and that, in fact, the board recognized in its comments that whether one calls an incremental cost
fixed
or...
Well, under your theory, they don't have to be incremental. Under your theory, they don't have to be, right? Under your theory, they just have to be costs related to a specific transaction.
That's correct. We agree with the board. Right. Let me be very clear about this. Mm-hmm. We agree with the board that, you know, in that Romanet little I and Romanet little II do not define mutually exclusive universes, and that there is another category of costs, specifically costs that are specific to particular transactions but are not incremental ACS costs that can be included. Our further submission is that the four categories of costs at issue here, including what Your Honor was referring to as fixed costs, are in fact incremental ACS costs in any event.
What about I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, let me just try to sort of make my point about this fixed versus average variable. When we're talking about fixed costs that are specific to a particular transaction, we are talking about hardware, software, and the dedicated personnel necessary to effectuate that. And whether one views those costs, and the board recognized this in its comments, as, quote, fixed or, quote, variable, depends on the time period that you're looking at and the volume range that you're looking at. And because, in any event, the statute talks about incremental costs, I mean, the cost that it takes an issuer to go from zero transactions to one are huge. It may not be, they may be lesser if you're looking in terms of the extra pennies that have to be submitted for transaction 2, 3, and 4. But if you have a system that can accommodate 20,000 debit transactions or 20,000 debit transactions in a day and your volume goes up to 20,001, those additional costs in hardware, software, and personnel are incremental as to that additional transaction, which is the reason why we think the board was right in saying we don't really have to decide which definition of incremental we're not deciding whether these four categories of costs are incremental or not, because
what about A5? Counsel for the board said that the transaction monitoring and fraud prevention, that process is essentially one. There are quite a few circumstances in the history of regulation of prices where regulators have drawn somewhat arbitrary, to be sure, but nonetheless workable distinctions between joint costs. The separations process in the telephone industry is an example. So why shouldn't the board have made some stab at that?
I think you're quite right that agencies have made an effort to draw lines that are sometimes difficult to discern and may or may not be the best place. This, of course, is a question. The question in this case is whether the line that the board drew was within its competence given the dictates of the statute. What the board said here was, look, fraud comes up in three possible ways in terms of costs. One are fraud losses. Nobody thinks that that has to do with fraud prevention. And, you know, I can address the issue of fraud losses if one wants, but it seems to me that these fraud losses are the paradigmatic cost that are specific to particular transactions. Then there's fraud prevention. And the merchants, you know, make a point about saying, well, A5 deals with fraud prevention, but there is an element of the transaction monitoring process that also serves the purpose of fraud prevention, which is correct. Now, what the board said was, with respect to, you know, network monitoring, that kind of the fraud prevention that occurs incident to a specific request to authorize, clear, and settle a particular debit transaction, that's included in costs that are recoverable in the base.
See that the language covers that cost, but in two categories. And the upshot of the board's decision is that it's removed altogether from one category, which appears to cover it, and put entirely in the other. And the effect of that is to relieve the issuers with respect to that amount, of the complying with the board's rules on it. What it must do.
Oh, I would have to disagree with you. I mean, you and I could either agree or disagree about whether the distinction that the board drew is the best one or the one that we would. But what they said is we are going to distinguish between fraud prevention activities in general, that is research and development on how to harden the system, or, to give you a specific example, I got an email last night, as it turns out, from my card company asking me to call, and I called, and they told me that they had charged my wife's card for auto repair services, I kid you not, in Toronto, Ontario, yesterday, and they wanted to know whether the person who called did acknowledge that there were also three or four charges at the White Flint Mall on her card. But they were calling because they thought this was suspicious. They had
so that goes in the A5 category.
They had this right. That call goes in the A5 category because they had already processed the thing. But they were calling, and under guidelines that the board does promulgate, they were calling after the fact to ascertain whether something needed to be done with that duplicate card.
Why can't the board do one of two things? One is to draw a line, partly arbitrary, between the two types of transaction monitoring costs, fraud prevention and other, and either put the pure fraud prevention into A5, subject to the compliance with the regulation, or say that if the issuer wants to do it that way, it can put it all in the transactions monitoring basket, but that, too, is subject to the compliance with the requirements of A5.
I'm not here arguing that the board could not have made that choice. I happen to think that the choice the board made, from the issuer's perspective, we just want to be compensated for the costs that we either necessarily undertake in the course of ACS or because the board has rules requiring us to do it. And the one thing I think we know for certainty here is that there's no intention in Congress to simply say, we are not going to allow issuers to recover their legitimate costs. The merchant's position here is that they should be able to recover from us only some of the costs, and they should go to the depositors to receive the other. And the notion that Senator Durbin or anybody else thought that the issuers should be transferring their costs onto small depositors is, I think, fanciful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. But let's stay with the interchange fee, if that's all right.
Sure.
Lift the lectern up.
Go ahead.
Just press the button on your right. Bottom to your right. Down.
Where, Judge? Sorry.
Can someone help him? You see the button there?
What are you suggesting is too low?
Yes. Yeah, okay. Lift it up.
I had already done that. I thought I had it at the right height. Sorry.
Okay.
Is that better? Okay. Sorry. Your Honor, the notion that there is a third bucket of costs here, that there is a category over which the board has discretion, is simply incorrect.
Well, can I suggest this? If you're going to launch into a discussion of which and that and commas, I think you might want to save your time. I think you can safely both think that the panel thinks that the critical fact is there's no comma in that sentence. There's no comma. The absence of a comma makes it a restrictive phrase. And so I think you should assume for purposes of argument. You're welcome to spend your time.
I think you should
spend your argument on the assumption that we think there are non-incremental ACS costs that are transaction-specific that can be included, and focus on these four categories.
Well,
that would be most helpful to us.
Yeah, no, and I wasn't going to spend any time on a comma.
Chevron step one, so you ought to move on.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You're not going to win on Chevron step one.
We win on either step because...
Well, but then what Judge Tittle is saying is focus on the real issue.
Sure. Look, the problem is the exclusion of the second category, the narrowing of the second category by the board. What the board has done is interpreted not specific to a particular transaction to mean not common to all transactions. They've done exactly the opposite of what the statute says and what the statute intends. So it's that definition. It's that major narrowing.
Well, other than the which and the that and the comma issue, what in the statute supports that?
What in the statute supports
that?
What do you
rely on other than the which that comma issue?
The meaning of specific in particular. I mean, these are two statutory phrases that work together. That
the statute talks about costs reasonable proportional to specific transactions.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Reasonable and proportional to specific transactions.
Yes, and the very next section says in determining what reasonable and proportion to to the transaction means, you have to take into account these considerations.
These two distinctions, correct. Now, the board took them into account, and now there's another pot of costs that don't fall into either one of those that can be included. And so I'm asking what in the statute supports your position that these costs at Chevron 1 can't be included?
Well, the plain meaning of particular and specific, that's what we're saying. What the board has done, to understand how the board includes fixed costs.
The board says that costs that are necessary for specific transactions to be executed are includable. And you think that that's barred at Chevron 1?
Those certainly aren't specific to a particular transaction.
So, an issuer has to have a computer to handle, right. Probably all the things. But the computer handles more than one transaction, right?
The point,
so what treatment is correct?
Yes, Your Honor. The point is that if a particular transaction can be processed without changing the cost, those are not costs that are specific to a particular transaction. And Your Honor, Judge Tatel, you point out the board's inconsistency here on page 65 and 66 of their brief in talking about A5.
Right.
The board says that when Congress wanted to speak about transactions as a whole, it used much different language than A4. But the board is also interpreting A4 in that very same way.
So I'm still not sure I get it. So is your argument are you now arguing that only incremental ACS costs can be included and that these aren't that, or are you saying that even if non-incremental ACS costs can be included, these aren't those?
Well, these are not.
What are you saying?
Well, I'm not saying that these are incremental ACS costs, and the board isn't saying that these are incremental ACS costs because the board hasn't even defined what an incremental ACS cost is. And you can't defer to what the board when it has failed to.
We're just not understanding what you're saying. Are you saying you disagree that B, little I, and double little I equal 100% or don't equal 100%?
We disagree that those equal 100% because of the structure of the entire statute.
So they don't equal, that means they're another set of costs.
No, I'm sorry, Your Honor. No, I think they equal 100%.
Well, we tried to tell you that at the beginning. You're climbing a really steep hill if you want to keep arguing there. That's your Chevron 1 type argument that the district court. We're trying to tell you you don't waste your time. None of us buy that.
Your Honor, it's either prong, however. I mean, it's the same sort of argument under step 2. And under, look, the fixed costs.
If you keep fighting the fight that little I and double little I capture the entire universe of costs, you have a really difficult argument to make. If you persist, that's your call. You've got the lectern,
no,
I don't.
No,
I'm
Your
telling
Honor,
you, you're wasting a lot of time.
No, Your Honor, all I'm saying is even if there were a third category of costs, and we've said that along, even if there were a third category of costs, these costs can't fall within it.
But your argument has to be at that point that the board's interpretation of the statute is unreasonable.
Right.
Well, we're in Chevron 2 land now. And you have to be able to make the argument that it's unreasonable for the board to say that cost specific to a specific transaction are all costs that make it possible for that transaction to occur. Your argument has to be that that's unreasonable.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean,
is that your argument?
Well, it is. It's part of our argument. It's always been our alternative argument that if you get to the second step, we still win.
Why don't you make that argument?
Well, part of the reason that first of all, you do have to look at the legislative history, and the legislative history here, to the extent it exists, completely supports the position that.
Well, now you're back to Chevron 1.
Well,
I was asking you why this is unreasonable.
This is unreasonable simply because if you look at the statute as a whole, it's clear that Congress didn't intend that these sorts of costs could be recovered.
And what other than the debate over which in that and the comma supports that, other than the language specific transaction?
Well, the existence of A5 itself supports this for transactions monitoring. I mean, you look at the board.
I assume that might be right or might not be right, but what about the other costs that they're talking about, apart from the costs that might be within the A5 category?
Apart from the costs that
the fraud. Apart from those fraud costs, there are other things that they're talking about. Why are they not?
Well, fraud losses are one of the things they're talking about.
No, I understand.
As well.
We'll take the fraud out for a minute. What about the other costs?
The fixed costs.
Yeah.
Your Honor.
Fix with respect to authorization, clearance, and settlement.
Yes, Your Honor. The statute specifically, the at par provision comes into play here, too. I mean, the entire purpose of the at par provision was to tell Congress that you should keep in mind that since 1915, checks, which these reasonably assimilate, have been clearing at par.
And that's why, and counsel for the board just told us that that's why they didn't include the costs of actually producing the cards, because they're kind of comparable to checks.
Well, but that's not what the Fed argued in their brief. Certainly, I mean
that's what she just told us.
Wrong?
What she just told us?
They've said something much different all along, which is that they didn't include those because they occur without regard to whether there's a particular transaction. I mean that's how they've always argued this.
Counsel, let me just try to get into the specific transaction bit. Suppose you have a machine that in its useful life handles a billion transactions. So each transaction incurs a cost of a billionth of the machine, right? Focusing solely on the cost of the machine. How do you think the statute requires that be treated? This is a case where marginal cost is actually corresponds with very short run incremental cost and is effectively zero. Is the answer?
Yes, Your Honor, that would be the answer. I mean, the answer
is... How does that produce reasonable and proportional charges?
How does that produce reasonable... I mean, what the Fed is saying is that, you know, we can completely disregard the use of the term incremental. I mean, Congress is...
No, you're quite wrong on that.
No.
Incremental clearly encompasses long-run incremental costs.
That might be if the Fed had gone there, but what they've said here is we don't even have to define that.
However, they did rightly say that the distinction between variable and fixed cost is really a matter of the time horizon you're looking at, and they chose a time horizon that encompasses fixed costs. What's wrong with that?
Well, Your Honor, again, the design of the statute was to assimilate check clearing, and we believe that is intended to put downward pressure on the fees and not allow these sorts of things.
The figure in one of the briefs about a very large sum that retailers lose on bad checks. So, did the board introduce that into its calculation at all? And if it did, wouldn't the fees skyrocket?
Well, Your Honor, I mean, the board did consider both similarities and differences.
But it never remotely tried to match the costs of bad checks.
The board did take those into account.
Well, all right. I'm not sure if it did very much, but in any event, that creates a kind of ceiling of kind that it seems to be nowhere near. These charges seem to be nowhere near.
I'm sorry, I don't quite understand your question.
Merchants are losing, I think the figure was $157 billion a year on bad checks. We have charges here which surely don't add up to that, do they?
No, they don't add up to that. Not the interchange fee, Your Honor.
I want to go back to something you said in response to a question when you were answering Judge Williams. And it has to do with the word incremental. You say these aren't incremental, right?
Right.
But if you're wrong about the reading of this statute, of A4B, this distinction, that is, if there is a category of costs related to a transaction that can be included that are not incremental ACS costs, then they don't have to be incremental. They only have to be related to a specific transaction, right?
That would be correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So then why did you answer Judge Williams by saying that fixed costs
maybe it's because I'm pig-headed, Your Honor.
But you would agree with me. They don't have to be incremental.
Well, if there's a third category,
if there's a third category,
you know, okay. that, then they don't have to be incremental. That's right.
Right.
But again, the focus of this entire exercise, is on the processing costs, and there are plenty of things that the board included that were not processing costs. So we think that at least as to the categories that we've identified, there is a Chevron problem under either step.
Mm-hmm.
Let me move on.
Talk about exclusivity for a minute.
Sorry, Your Honor.
Yeah, well, you go ahead. What do you want to?
Well, there's the non-exclusivity provision.
I was about to ask you about that.
What the board has done with respect to the non-exclusivity provision is to use the card as the proxy for the transaction. And we believe that fails under either step of Chevron as well. The board has the statute, as you know, says that the board shall not, or the board shall take steps that prevent the banks and the networks from restricting the number of networks on which an electronic debit transaction may be processed.
Right, and you're focusing on the word transaction. Right?
That's right. We're focusing
on. But the operative word in that sentence is network.
Well, it's network, an issuer.
No, it's network. When you were in elementary school, did you diagram sentences? If you were diagramming this sentence, the phrase on which an electronic transaction may be processed, that comes down below network. It modifies network. The key thing is network in this sentence, not transaction.
Well, Your Honor, again, it's issuer or network. That's all. That was my only point in that question. But the point is that the issuers and networks, the rule itself is setting up a system in which the issuers limit the number of networks on which a transaction may be processed. Now, one of the things that
limit the number of networks.
Number of networks on which a transaction may be processed.
Correct.
What's that?
Yeah, right.
So the very rule that the Fed has adopted violates the statute. Uh-huh. And the reason for that is as Congress recognized in recognizing that there are different methods of authentication of a transaction, Congress recognizes that when a customer goes to a merchant and presents the card, and says, I want this processed as a Visa credit transaction. The merchant has no choice whatsoever but to process that on one network. That's what the rule sets up.
And so when any new authentication method is devised, and it's an independent new network that offers it, all the issuers immediately have to encompass that network.
Well, Your Honor, our argument has never said it needs to be two of the same sort of network. What we are saying is that there have been rules historically and that continue that prevent signature transactions from being processed over PIN networks and vice versa. And those cross-routing rules, which...
Those rules are out.
Well, no, Your Honor. Quite frankly, we'd be happy if they were, Your Honor. We would view that as a victory if they were. But those rules still exist. The rules that have been cited to this court by Visa and MasterCard prevent a PIN transaction or a signature transaction from being routed over a PIN network, and those rules are still in place. What the board has cited is some limited exception that allows within a PIN network a PIN to be processed without a PIN, but it still prevents cross routing of these transactions, and we don't believe that the Fed's rule. I mean, we'd be happy if the court held them to it, but we don't believe that the Fed's rule prevents cross-routing. So the problem. I mean, there are a number of rules in play here. The Fed says here that when a customer makes the election, it's really the customer that is determining routing and not the issuer. Well, actually, Visa's rules require that a merchant honor the customer choice. Visa says if a customer comes in and says, I want this processed as a Visa transaction, that transaction has to be processed as a Visa transaction, as a credit or a signature transaction, and the merchant can't route in that circumstance. So it's very much Visa's rules that set up this whole problem. And this rule allows those sorts of rules to stay in place because, as the board recognizes, if you look at footnotes 160 and 165 of the final rule, the board recognizes that under this rule, there's only going to be one signature option for each of the for each transaction. It's always going to be Visa. It's always going to be MasterCard. It's always going to be Discover. Whatever that signature network is, the rule basically memorializes that. Judge Williams, we'd be very happy if cross-routing were in fact prohibited such that any PIN network could process a signature transaction. We don't believe that is the case. And in 2.5 years of litigation, the first time that representation was made by the board was in their reply brief in this court. And this was something that Judge Leon actually adopted, so you would have thought they would have addressed that in their opening brief. So we actually think that's just a post hoc rationalization. We're not very comfortable relying on it. But if it were true that cross-routing were allowed, that if a PIN network could in fact in any circumstance route a signature transaction, then 1&1 would be fine with us. It would in fact meet the statutory requirements. We don't think it does, and if we think a close parsing of Visa's rules and the rule at issue here doesn't provide for that, Your Honor. So our position is that, yes, Your Honor, network and issuer and restrictions are part of this rule, but it's the networks and issuers that are restricting the choice for the merchant. There are no more questions, Your Honor?
Anything else? Thank you. Neither counsel any time left, right? Okay. Ms. Wheatley, you can take 2 minutes if you'd like it.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just wanted to respond on the issue of network exclusivity. I'm puzzled, actually, by the statements because our rule specifically permits, if there is a new network out there that can figure out how to do SIG and PIN transactions at the same time, which actually that's happening now, so there is such a network, our rule says a payment card network may not restrict or otherwise limit an issuer's ability to contract with that other payment card network. That's 235.7A3. So any kind of restriction that Visa might want to put on saying that the issuers that issue their cards can't go to some other network in addition, that if there is a rule like that, it violates our rule. I don't believe there is such a rule, but it would not comply with our rule if it existed. So the board's rule provides that networks and issuers cannot restrict to fewer than two the number of networks that can operate a card. If there are restrictions put on the ability to operate one of those networks, for example, a merchant chooses not to have PIN technology, that is not a restriction that this statute or our regulation is addressed to, and there's no need for it to be. So as far as cross-routing rules are concerned, there are no restrictions on cross-routing. The practical restrictions that result from the fact that the technology infrastructure is different, those are not restrictions imposed by networks or issuers. Thank you. That completes my time. Thank you, Your
Honor. Mr. Waxman, do you need a minute or two?
I'm happy to answer any questions that the court has. Otherwise, I'm happy also to waive rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you. Case is submitted.